Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Diane G.
Thank you. Thanks, Rich. Hi, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Diane. I love the set-aside prayer. My home group opens up with the set-aside prayer, and every time I work with a sponsee, we say the set-aside prayer because it helps me to just pause, ground myself, and know that I can have a new experience in all these things, and I remain teachable when I finish that prayer in a deep breath. It's really a beautiful prayer. And it comes right from the big book. So many of my sponsees would say, well, why do we use this in AA? And there are certain phrases throughout our first 164 pages that have been used to put that prayer together. So my home group is Sunlight of the Spirit. We meet on Friday nights in Colts Neck, New Jersey, 7:30. I don't know if any of you will be down there because this is a hike, but I was telling Jonathan before the meeting, I got up over this hill and I saw those beautiful mountains out there, and it was breathtaking, and it makes me realize that God is always alive, and it was just beautiful. So thank you for the invitation from this group. My sobriety date is November 7th, 2000. I have a home group, I told you, and I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, and she has a sponsor, and I sponsor women. And I always say that because it reminds me of what Ebby brought to Bill and Bill passed on to Bob and so forth and so forth. And that allows me to be alive and sober today as a result of one alcoholic passing this message on to another. And I must never take this gift for granted. And when I don't do this work with yet others, I'm being selfish and inconsiderate to this gift that God's given me. And I got here by no desperation. I got here not because I wanted to be here. I'm sure no one did. But I never had an intention to stop drinking. I was going to be one of those, and not consciously thinking this, but that was going to go on to the bitter end. You see, alcohol took me, and then I'll back up a little just so I can qualify, from a loving home, a husband, and three children, to a park bench where I grew up homeless, with a brown bag of vodka in my backpack and a blanket because it was getting cold. And somebody kept stealing my blanket when I would hide it in the morning. But that's where alcohol took me. You see, because I learned when I got here, I suffered from a threefold disease. And I wasn't a bad person, and I could never have done this on my own. I couldn't have willed it away like my family thought that I should be able to do. Can't you just stop? But I never wanted to stop. But I didn't know that I couldn't, even if I wanted to, by myself. The disease I suffer from is mental, physical, and spiritual. And I have this mental obsession that tells me to take the next drink, that once I do that, I trigger the physical craving, the phenomenon for alcohol in my body, because my body's as abnormal as my thinking, and I'm off to the races. And that could be 2 days, 3 days, a week, a month, or continuous drunkenness, which was what it was at the end of my drinking. And the spiritual malady that I suffer from, because I always thought I had power over everyone and everything in my life, including alcohol in the beginning, just to realize that I was truly powerless over alcohol because I couldn't stop, and I was running the show. I can tell you I grew up with a religion that I believed in a God. I believed in a loving and forgiving God, contrary to my 10 brothers that we grew up in the same household, that were shocked when I told them that they had such a punishing God in their life. But my God was loving and forgiving. What was wrong with that thinking was I never had a relationship with this God. And that's what I have today. And through this relationship with God, one day at a time, I get to stay sober. One day at a time, when my relationship is right with God, all my other relationships in my life are right, no matter what that looks like. And that's a beautiful thing. So I started drinking at 17, and I'm just going to just qualified. I pretty much just did once I started at 17. Didn't know then, but when I got sober, I realized I was an alcoholic from the first drink. I lived in, was raised in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, which is across the outer bridge from Staten Island, New York. And at the time, drinking was 18. So we were 17, and my girlfriends and I decided to go over to Staten Island after school one day and drink. And the thing is like I didn't stop, and they threw me in the back seat. I threw up. They threw a blanket over my head, and I couldn't wait to do it again the next weekend. So I was always, if I wasn't drinking, thinking about how I was going to get the drink. And that continued through high school, which was just one more year. I go off to college the next year, and it was easier because I didn't have my parents, I wasn't home, and I didn't have to sneak. I could drink whenever I wanted. Somehow I managed through all my drinking. I was already a full-blown alcoholic. Even though I wasn't drinking every day, when I picked up the drink, I didn't stop. I managed to graduate from this junior college in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, with honors. I have no idea how that happened. But I was on a roll. So from there, I decided I'm going to go on to a four-year college. And because my brother was at Villanova, so there was still a little control, you know, over me. And I decided I was going to go to the University of Miami. So here I off. I go to Florida, and no, there was nobody looking over my shoulder or watching me. I could do whatever I wanted to do. So I started school off with classes in the daytime, drinking in the evening, and that didn't quite work out so well. So next semester, I switched to night classes so I can drink in the day, and that didn't work out so well. And somehow I managed to finish that school, too. Certainly not with honors, but that's okay. And I come back to New Jersey, and now I can't live with my parents and my siblings because there's a whole lot of little ones there, and I'm not willing to follow their directions. So I start drinking, and I do get a job in social services. Not again, I didn't stop drinking, but drinking at the... We lived in a small town. There was a corner bar here and there and everywhere where my brothers and I would go drink, and that's where I met my husband. Should have ran, but I didn't. And my now ex-husband. and so we move in together. Seemed like a great idea. I didn't want to live at home. I didn't want to follow rules. And he didn't really have any place to live. So we got our place together. And a year later, we got married. And my drinking just continued. It didn't really escalate, although this is a progressive fatal disease. You'll see in my story as I continue to drink, it certainly progresses. We get married, and the next year I have a child, and I'm working. I'm still kind of what you would call a functional alcoholic, drinking, getting things that I needed to get done and drinking every other moment. You know, making sure that dinner was on the table and things were done, get my child to bed and drink all night and get up or come too. So we have another child, and I have three boys, and we decide to move from hometown to the shore in New Jersey. And my husband worked up north, so now he was gone. So things really changed, and I would get up with a drink. I would have a drink while I'm getting the children ready for school. And then I wasn't working at this point down there yet, and drink all day and get things done and make sure that dinner was ready and get the homework done and then drink some more. You know, I would try and control the drinking at this point so I was able to be some kind of mother. And the truth be told, I was a horrible mother because when my youngest went to kindergarten, I would pass out by the time that his bus would come home and not meet him at the bus stop. They would bang on my living room window, looking at me, passed out on the couch, and I couldn't come too. The school would call me, and I'd have to go down there and get him. Why they released him to me, I have no idea, because obviously I was drunk. But time after time after time, you know, I never showed up for my children. And yet I told you I loved them. And I did love them, but alcohol was more important. Alcohol was so consuming and so necessary, it had now become my master, like it talks about in the big book. And I'm drinking around the clock. And the arguments at home ensue. And it becomes ugly. And years go on. And I have now trips to the hospital, coming to on the gurney. And how Bill says, how did I get here again? Laying there, strapped down, looking at these strobe lights and saying again and again and again, how did I get here again? Mind you, never swearing off alcohol. Not ever promising any of them, I'm not going to drink again. And I go home just to do it again. And for God's reason, not mine, I'm alive today and I'm sober woman here standing before you. Several DUIs later, I end up in jail. The judge offers me rehab or jail, and this is the sick alcoholic I am. So, Your Honor, how long am I going to jail? So he tells me, how long do you want me to go to rehab? And that was 1 month longer than the jail sentence. So I raise my hand and say, okay, I'll go to jail. Thank you very much. I go to jail. I go to jail. I don't drink in jail, and you can drink in jail. And I get out, and my dad's there. My dad. My dad is a retired deputy police chief in our hometown. Picks his only daughter up from jail. And from there, you know, I get to go do the family shuffle because my husband has already left me. He's taken our three children and he's moved to the other side of the country to get away from the drunk. And one brother after another, as long as you don't drink, you can stay here. My one brother was in the program and he said to me, just don't drink and go to these meetings, because that's what he was doing, going to these meetings. He had several years in AA. And I said, I could go to these meetings. I never agreed to not drink, but I can go to these meetings. And I did with my bottle of vodka in my backpack, and I was the one who would get up several times in the meeting to go to the bathroom and take a swig of the vodka, come back and sit down next to you. And you never told me not to come back. So I did that, and then I got found out because I left a bottle at his house, and there I come back from one of these meetings, and the bottle of my, I owned one black large garbage bag of belongings at this point in my life, and a bottle of vodka. And it was in the driveway. To the next brother, same thing. And then finally, my dad let me move in with him until he knew I was drinking. Everyone always knows we're drinking. No, we're the only one that thinks no one. I'm the only one that thought no one knew I was drinking. And my dad's sleeping one night, and I fell asleep on his little chair there, and I had the bottle under the pillow on the couch, and I said, oh, he's still asleep. I'll just take a swig. Well, he wasn't asleep, and the next day he put me out. And nowhere else to go, you know. So I'm thinking, well, I'll just sleep in his backyard. He'll open the door, and he'll let me back in. Well, I slept in his backyard for 3 nights, and he never opened the door, and he never let me back in. So from this beautiful family of a husband, three children, and my dad and all my siblings, is no one wants me. And honestly, that was okay. You know, when I did inventory with my sponsor, she said, so when your husband took your children to California, did you try and get them back? Did you try and go out there? Did you try and reconcile the family? I said, no. Now I could drink the way I wanted to drink, and he was off my back. The same with when I was homeless, I was able to drink around the clock. You know, I was collecting unemployment at the time because I had gotten fired from a waitress job. And so that allowed me to buy my booze. I never thought that I should go find a hotel or a motel or someplace to sleep with this money. It was a good idea that I go to get liquor. It wasn't even a thought that I should go buy food. That was better to just pick out of the garbage can behind the local restaurants. It was all about the alcohol because my mind kept telling me, for whatever reason, and it doesn't matter. This is the unmanageability of my life. No matter whatever the trivial reason is I need that drink. And my body is so sickened now that it just needs to continue to have alcohol. So it's getting to be wintertime. Now I'm in the streets, I guess, since like the beginning of June. And my brothers like decide that they're going to, unknown to me, do something about this. And I always say that they loved me enough when they did this, that until I could love myself, that they, if you call this love, they had me arrested because they found out I had some fines down in Ocean County. I have a brother who's an attorney and a brother who's a police officer. And so they were able to manage to get a warrant for these couple of $100 fines I had to get me in jail till they found me the very same rehab that the judge had offered me the year before. So I end up in that very same rehab, which is quite funny. God's laughing the whole time because he knew he was going to get me there. It just was a matter of when. And I get arrested, and I guess it was about a week later, I found this out just a few months ago how long. I had no idea how long I was in that jail that time, but it was a week. And two of my brothers picked me up, and I get in the car, and I'm in these clothes that I was arrested in, which are urine-infested, feces-infested, smelling that I had been living in for I have no idea how long. And I'm still thinking about how I'm going to get the next drink. Like, I'm in this back seat, and they're laughing and talking, and I'm like, okay, how am I going to, you know, where am I going, and how am I going to get a drink? And they say to each other, when you get to the green fence, we're there. Okay, so where am I going? So we get to this green fence, and I was like, okay, I think my life's over right about now. I don't think I'm going to have a drink between me and the green fence. So let's see where this leads to. It was the rehab. It was the rehab. It was at the Mental Hospital Institute, that was now one of the buildings turned into a long-term drug and alcohol rehab. And what God did for me that day is absolutely what I could have never done for myself. And this is my experience, is when I got to that front door, the obsession for alcohol was removed. God's white aura came about me, and I haven't had a desire for a drink since that day. And that was, I believe, November 14th, 2000. But my last drink was November 7th. And I never looked back. Because, you see, once I stepped foot into this rehab, I was willing this much to learn how to stay stopped. That was going to be enough. Just teach me how to stay stopped. I knew nothing about these 12 steps and these principles and that this was, you know, having a relationship with a higher power. I knew nothing. Because I went to those meetings drunk, and I never heard a thing. So I get there, and I become willing. I surrender. What God did for me at that front door allowed me to surrender. And as my stay went on there, I had a shift from just teaching me how to stay stopped to getting an open mind enough to hear what you had to say. And then I got desperate. I got desperate to have this and have what you had, because women were coming in there and they had a life beyond what I could have ever imagined. And they hadn't picked up a drink for a while, and even a year sounded like a long time at that time for me, you know. But I'll never forget the first day that I sat there. A young man was leaving that day, and he had been like the peer guru or something. They give you these positions in rehab. And he really, to me, sounded like he had, and he was going to go out, and he was going to stay sober. And 3 months later, they tell us he was dead. So that really gave me more desperation to do what was necessary to stay sober. So they told me to get a sponsor. They told me to get a sponsor who was experience in these 12 steps that could take me through this work. And when I left there, and I was there for 6 months, actually I was there for five, and then fifth month the counselor says to me, is we're going to keep you another. And I said, that's okay. That was just so okay with me, because things were starting to change. I still hated my ex-husband for taking our children 3,000 miles away. I had no relationship with my children. I was able to call them once a week, and they wouldn't come to the phone. As a matter of fact, they wouldn't come to the phone for almost 3.5 years, my sobriety, because they still didn't believe that I wasn't going to drink again. And so, how do you show, not tell someone 3,000 miles away you're not drinking? Somehow God did that. Anyway, so I go out and I come here to AA. And where I went to in Freehold was where I moved to. Women weren't open and forthcoming, and I was an outpatient, and my counselor kept saying is, I don't care, just keep reaching out to them. Just keep, you know, aren't they supposed to come to me? I'm the new person. There's my ego still glaring, right? You know, I wasn't right-sized yet by God. So I'm like, I'm the new person here. So, I kept listening. For the first time in my life, I started to follow directions. You know, and that's what I've come to learn this program is I have to follow the directions that are outlined in this big book for me. And so I listened to women share, and I went up and I finally asked a woman to sponsor me. Didn't know anything about her, but God did, because this woman had gone through the work. She had some time in the program, and she was willing to take me through these steps. And what this woman gave me at 1 year sober was relief. And God knew that that was enough to keep me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just that relief. It wasn't enough for me to be happy, joyous, and free, but it was enough to keep me here until I found my current sponsor a few years later, and she took me through the work again, and then again, and then again, and then again. But that's what I need. I need to keep revisiting these steps and being very current in inventory. But what my second sponsor gave me after we had done the work and we sat down, and I came to believe that this God can restore me to sanity. And I didn't know that what that meant. I was going to meetings for a year, and I thought the insanity was the things I did when I was drinking. It had nothing to do with that. What an awakening when she told me that. It was my thinking, that mental obsession that kept telling me that I needed the next drink for whatever reason that was. The byproduct of that and picking up the drink was the stupid things I did. That was just a byproduct, and we all have our own stupid things that we did when once we took that next drink. And then took me to the third step. And what I learned in the second and third step is at that point I did not have to understand God. All I needed to get in my gut is I needed this power. I needed it. The understanding, she kept telling me, would come. The relationship would come. And it absolutely did once I wrote inventory. And I started to unblock all the things that I had put in front of God. The behaviors, the defects, the way I treated people, the way I mistreated people. You know, my ego. You know, I had to smash my ego and right-size myself and humble myself, and that comes later in the steps for me. So I have to write down all this inventory, you know, and from the first to the second to the third to the fourth, all the same people, mostly all the same people. It's my children, it's my ex-husband, it's my siblings, it's my dad. My dad, she said on the fourth inventory, God, Diane, how old is he? I said, he's 80 years old. She kept saying that and asked me that. And you have still another resentment to him? He's 80 years old? Change already. And what I have to do is change my thinking. Just because the drink has been removed, all right? I'm powerless over alcohol. That's been removed. I am still powerless over everyone and everything in my life. And when I accept that powerlessness over my dad and my siblings and my children and my ex-husband, is I get peace. I get the beautiful promises of the 10th step. Is I have ceased fighting everyone and everything, including alcohol. It also goes on to say in the 10th step promises, which are some my favorite, is that I don't even have to swear it off today. I've been placed in a position of neutrality from a woman who could never stop drinking, never intended to stop drinking. I'm in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. Wow, when that happened for me, and that was at 9.5 years sober. So I was pretty crazy. But that's okay. Inventory works. And good sponsorship. You know, when I sat down and did all those fifth steps, my sponsor sits there with me and gently and kindly, and sometimes not so gently, points out my faults, my mistakes, my wrongs, not my part, because that's assuming then that they had a part, and it's not their inventory, it's mine, she told me. So they have no part, I had no part. It was my wrongs. It was your faults, Diane. It was your mistakes. Inevitably, I started the ball in motion all the time. And then they did something and pissed me off, and then, like, I get even more sore. And that can still crop up. But my 11th step, well, 10th step, when they crop up, I get to do a check-in. You know, but my nightly inventory really catches these things in the evening. You know, when I can take a look at my day, and if any of my defects of character are glaring, I know what I'm taking to morning prayer when I get quiet with God after I do that review. But the biggest thing came for me, it was in 6 and 7. And it was in 9.5 years sober when I did this fourth inventory. My dad, 80 years old, was ridiculous. My siblings still on there because they love me enough. And then I turned my back on them because their egos were so big when I would go to family events. And so I stopped going to family events, and then they stopped inviting me to family events. And here's my ego. Don't they know who I am? Their only sister. Now they don't invite me. Well, I had to do some work on that. And they still haven't changed, but I can go to these family events today with my siblings, and they can still do the same thing, and I don't take them home. I can show up and bring to the event, the party, the celebration, joy, happiness, my God, my living God, and be present at that moment. And so I change because that 6, 7, 7, that list of my defects that were glaring in that last inventory made me want to vomit. I was still showing up 9.5 years sober in all the very same defects of character that I was showing up at 1 year sober. And I'm sponsoring women, and I'm sharing at meetings, and I'm living this way. So my prayer life changed. Before that inventory, I was asking God to remove these things that were disturbing to him. Help me not be inconsiderate. Help me not be manipulative. My prayer life shifted after this inventory to, please God, help me to be loving, to be what you want me to be. And loving, I had to break down to what that meant. Because I can be loving, but what was that looking like for me? Respectful, considerate, compassionate, understanding, patience, loving, kind. And I really broke it down. And those were the things, that's what I was asking God in my morning prayer to be what he wants me to be what he's created me, recreated me from what I should have been all along. And I still don't like my ex-husband. But I do love him as a child of God, and that's okay. Our son was married last year. One of our sons was married last year, and it teased my son because his dad, I was like, so where's your dad going to sit? I was sitting with my brother and his godfather and my sponsor, and he said, well, Mom, he's going to sit there. I said, well, can he sit with the bride's family? And so, jokingly. No. I said, of course he's going to sit at my table. And I actually honestly like his girlfriend better than I like him, but that's beside the point. And it was a wonderful evening. It really was. I prayed before the day began, and God, please don't let me use my mouth in a wrong way. You know, and I didn't. We were there brought to the celebration. And that's because of the work I did in 6 and 7. Then even more, 8 and 9. 8 is so simple for me. And then bring it to 9. 8 is a list. 9. From the power of steps 1 through 8, I get to show up and do 9. In the power from steps 1 to 8, I get to do 9. It took me 7 years to make an amends to my ex-husband. And part of it was because of the distance. He's still in California, although now he lives in New Jersey, but he was in California. And the first time I wanted to make amends, I was gung-ho going out there, and I was going to tell him how much he hurt me before I was going to tell him how I hurt him. And my sponsor kept telling me, you better start praying harder, Diane. That is not the spirit of forgiveness. So I prayed. And in a big book, it tells us in Freedom from Bondage, this is a woman who talks about the resentment she had towards her mom, to pray for her. She prayed for her for 2 weeks and prayed for her to have what she had: happiness, freedom, peace, joy, prosperity. And so I started praying that for him. I prayed for 7 years. And I prayed, and for the first couple of years, I couldn't pray for his prosperity. I prayed for everything else, and finally I was able to pray for his prosperity, because I didn't want him to have money, because I didn't have money. So, but see, God teaches me lessons all the time when I seek him. And that wasn't righteous. It was self-righteous. And I've learned the difference today. I get to live a righteous life, a right life with God. So I make my amends. I finally was able to make my amends to my children. My one son, my middle son, he said to me, I thought I was going to bury you, Mom. What a terrible thing a son has to think for his mom, that they're going to bury you. Today, 2 of my 3 children are in Alcoholics Anonymous. My middle son, who said that to me when he made amends to me, he's 11 years sober now. I had said the same thing to him. I thought I was going to bury him because that's what alcohol had done in his life. This disease is fatal. It wants us dead. It'll take us drunk, I always hear, but it wants me dead. And then my oldest son, he came in at the same time 11 years ago and had a few years sober and went out, and it got worse. And you know, God shows me. It gets worse. It never gets better. No one's ever come back here and said, Diane, boy, it was great out there. That's why I'm back. That's if we're lucky enough, if they're lucky enough to make it back, because the other alternative is death. And so many people I've known in Alcoholics Anonymous have died of this disease. And thank God, by the grace of God, my oldest son didn't die. He came back. He struggled a few more years. Went back to California, but it got worse and came back. And now he's 5 years sober. And he went back to California. And he took his recovery with him this time. You know, he's got a home group, and he's doing what's necessary one day at a time to stay sober and live in this spiritual life. So I was just actually out in California for a visit. I have 2 sons still live out there and 2 grandchildren. And it's always a joy to get out there and see them. Certainly not as much as I'd like to. And God just teaches me all the time. Because I come back and my sponsor asked me how it was. And I said, God just showed me, you know, my perception of what my family should look like, and that's myself and my three sons. They're adults. I have 3 30-year-olds. They're really adults. My perception of what that should look like is not what it looks like. And I want it to be this, like, rosy, comfy, cozy little, nice little thing. They all love each other and call each other and call me. And it's not. And I just have to accept that that is never going to be the way I want it to be. Do not get me wrong. I have a very loving relationship with all 3 of my children, and our family is a loving family. It's just that I have this perception of unrealistic. So God smacks me upside my head because I said something to my oldest son at breakfast one morning, and he just like barked at me, and I was like, whoa. I thought I was saying something kind, so I ran to pass my sponsor, and she said, you said nothing wrong. You know, I was telling him I was praying for his happiness. And so that's when the revelation came that, you know, it's not going to be the way I want it. And he, whatever was going on with him, was going on with him. And I have to walk away and be okay. I just have to remember, and I say things to my children as their mother, and I remind them when I do, I don't say it to hurt them, and I don't say it to be mean, just like any person in my life that I love and care about, is because if I don't say it to you as your mother, and I care enough, then who's going to say it to you? You know? And these are simple things, not directions. I don't give them directions, but more or less put in question, you know, don't you think, or, you know, isn't it possible? And just reach out to them like that. But it's because I love them enough today, like my brothers loved me enough to do something to help me save my life. So I make all these amends. I make amends to my dad. I make amends to my brothers, and I go on to live in 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. You know, the biggest joy in my life, besides sharing and living in the sunlight of the Spirit and sharing my God with you, and not by telling you, but by showing you and being a presence of love and light the best I can, is seeing the light go on in another alcoholic's eyes. When a sponsee is sitting across the table from me and she hasn't a clue what God is, or doesn't know she's an alcoholic, or doesn't want to be an alcoholic but is an alcoholic, and we start doing this work and we start getting into some considerations and some questions, and then the light goes on. And then she passes it on to somebody else. And then they pass it on to someone else. And so that guarantees me that AA will be here when my grandchildren may need it, or my great-grandchildren may need it, or even their children. Because this works. It's worked for all this time. And by Ebby bringing it to Bill and Bill bringing it to Bob all those years ago, nothing in the first 164 pages, the directions outlined for a vital spiritual experience necessary for this alcoholic to stay sober, works in my life. And I can never rest on my laurels, the book tells me. Never rest on my laurels. I can't think what I've done all these years up to now is enough to keep me sober today, is enough to keep me sober tomorrow. One of my favorite steps is 11, but the most important step in my life is step 1. Every day I have to admit powerlessness, not only over alcohol, but everything. Otherwise, I'm screwed. In plain language, I can go to work and think I have power over the customers, my boss, or my coworkers, and I just become miserable. I just, in turn, then put that on to other people, you know? And that's not my life today. So powerlessness, my first step, is the most important step in my recovery. Step 11 keeps me in every 24 hours. It starts in the evening. The directions for me are there. I always love to go to the last page of that step where it says, we alcoholics are undisciplined, therefore we need to be disciplined by exactly what was just outlined. I'm in a group of women called Steel on Steel, and we meet on a monthly basis. And one of the questions is, since the last time we met, how many times have you done nightly review? Now, the question is, how many times have you done nightly review? I do nightly review every night. And a couple of the women say, maybe 2 or 3 times a week. I'm really slacking. And so this is a group that we get to, with love, call each other out on and deepening our relationship with God and in these spiritual principles. So, well, doesn't nightly review mean every night? How do I take what I need to ask God to help me be better at tomorrow in my morning prayers if I don't know how I showed up the day before? Some days, you know, I'm packing in the stream of life. I am being everything God wants me to be. Some days, a day or two here or there, I'm being the evil twin of that. And that's why I get to sit down in the evening and look at that. And it's not at midnight or 11 o'clock or when I'm hopping into bed, because if I need to talk to my sponsor about something, I'm not calling her at 11 o'clock. I'm coming home from work, and maybe after seeing a sponsee, 7, 8 o'clock, I'm sitting and I'm getting quiet. And I sit after I look at my day and where I've fallen short and how can I make corrective measures, God, and what could they be and where was I showing love and kindness and packing in the stream of life. And I get to sit in that. And my evening meditation, my quiet time is a little longer than my morning time. And it varies night to night. I have no regimen except for sitting in that chair every night and looking at my day and getting quiet. So I go to morning prayer, and in the morning it says, on awakening, the next discipline in my step 11, ask God to direct my thinking, remove me of selfishness and self motives, you know, to be what he would have me be in this day. And the best direction is to pause then when agitated. Third discipline, just to stop. Can I do that? Most days I can do that. When I feel like ego is cropping up and I want to act out, or you've been sarcastic or mean to me and I want to in turn be the same way. And trust me, there's times that I am in the same way, especially with customers at work. And my Steel on Steel group has just so pointed that out to me. And I practice on a daily basis, no matter how I'm treated, that in turn I can be respectful to you as a child of God. And I do. And work with the customers has really been a lot better, that it's not showing up in my evening review much lately. But I can. I could be scornful. I can be sarcastic. And I could, like, not talk to you when you're talking to me. Just, like, pretend you're not existing. And those are all my character defects. Well, not all of them. Just some of them. And when I pause, I take a deep breath or two or three, and I have a different light about me. And that's as a result of the quiet time I spend with God every day. In the morning, it might be 5 or 10 minutes. In the evening, it might be 15. Weekends, I love, especially Sunday morning, because I'm not rushing out the door, my only day off. So I really get to spend time with God a little more in the morning on Sundays. And when I was in California, my oldest son, took me to a meditation practice, and we sat in silence. There was about 50 people there for about 45 minutes. And the energy was amazing. I get to do those things with my sons today. You know, from not talking to me for almost 3.5 years of my sobriety, to have the individual relationship I have with each of them, that when they do need my advice as a mom, they do call me because they know they're going to get the truth. And this program, Alcoholics Anonymous and a Loving God, has taught me to tell the truth. I was a liar, a thief, a cheat, a manipulator, and so forth and so forth and so on. But today, to the best of my ability, I stay in the consciousness of the presence of God. And you know, when at work, my boss is, I don't want to say he's psycho, but he's a little off the charts. And he can't do two things at once, and he gets very frustrated easily. And you know, and I've seen the change in him, and I've seen and I've witnessed, and it's been revealed to me when we're lifted, when we get lifted through these spiritual principles and that relationship with God, the people around us get lifted. It just happens. It just, you know, it's just amazing how God works in our lives, and he just laughs and laughs and laughs at things I think. 2 years ago, my oldest brother, he died, and I didn't cry. I was taught as a child not to cry, because I would be given something to cry for, so I didn't want that. But I cried. You know, this brother and my other brother were the two that helped find this rehab for me. And because of a loving God and the way I live today, I got to show up for him. I got to sit with him at his bedside as he was suffering and he was dying. He, in the end, it was in and out of the hospital. And the weekend before he died, I had a commitment up at the Wilson House. And I had been practicing on him for weeks when I'd visit him about my share that I was going to share up there. It was a spiritual retreat. And he knew how much it meant to me. And that Friday I left, he went back into the hospital. And he and my other brother, they didn't tell me because they knew I wouldn't go. They wanted me to go. And I came home on Sunday to find out he was in the hospital. He died the following Wednesday. God knew I needed to come back and see him. And I got to do the night vigil. That was my duty. I would do the night shift. And the night before he passed away, I for some reason, went back to his room three times. There was something that kept drawing me back and sitting with him, holding his hand and praying. And the next morning he went on morphine and I was at work. And I got a call and I immediately left. It's a 20-minute ride to the hospital. 10 minutes into my ride, my brother called me and told me he had passed. And I sobbed. I never sobbed like I sobbed like that. And I had a hole in my heart. And I don't know if I'll ever get over it, but I certainly have moved on. And I get to share with others and pass that on, that we get to be there, you know. In turn, we get to do for others. You know, service in step 12 doesn't mean just with other alcoholics. It means with everybody. I'm going to end with this. This is another story about my service. My mom died 20 years ago, and I was a raging alcoholic. I'm one of 11 children, 10 brothers. I'm the only daughter. I was the only child that was not at her bedside when she drew her last breath. Because the night before, we were all gathered at her bed, and I had to go home because I told you I had to go get my children ready for school. I had to go home because I had to go home and drink. I couldn't stay there and drink the way I needed to drink. The next morning, I come to on the couch at 6:30 to a flatline sound in my head. And the next minute after that, I get a call from my sister-in-law that my mom had passed. I had already known because of that. I woke up to that flatline. The remorse and the guilt that I carried for years and years into my sobriety until I finally made peace with the harm that I caused my mom. And it was through a meditation that God came and said to me, she wants you to just keep doing what you're doing. It's okay. And then he puts a woman in my life. I meet in AA. And she befriends me. And her name is Louise. My mom's name was Louise. A couple months after that, Louise says to me, Diane, I'm dying. I have cancer. My mom died of cancer, the very same cancer that Louise had. And here's God allowing me to living amends to another woman, to be there and hold her hand, read her Bible, bring her AA meetings while she was on hospice until her last breath. Thank you, God. Not too long after that, I move into an old age facility, I was going to say. Well, I told my grandson I'm 51 years older than him. That sounded terrible last weekend. But anyway, 55 and older community. My neighbor on the corner there, we live on top floor, Annie, dear Annie, she was 92. And I became friends with her. I just loved Annie. She had all her wits about her. The only thing, she was very hard of hearing, so I'd have to shout all the time. But she would shuffle. I'd take her to church when her church people were on vacation. I'd bake for her. And then my oldest son stayed with me for a while. And she, 90-something now, 95, and she thinks he's hot. And my son would laugh and say, oh my gosh, Mom, she likes me more than she likes you. And she did, because her daughter would visit from California and bring chocolates to her. And she would say to her daughter, go take these over to Shay. Give them to Shay. Oh, can you ask him to come over and fix this? And her daughter would say, it's not broken. Anyway, But we became almost family because Annie's sister, a daughter, would come and visit, and she would come over and bring me chocolates too, not only my son. But earlier this year, Annie died. And I got to live immense yet again to my mom through Annie. Thank you, God. And the day Annie died, her daughter was here that weekend from California. I had gone out to walk my dog, and I was coming back, and her daughter says to me from the landing, "Is Diane, my mom's going to die tonight. Would you like to come in? You were a very good friend to her, and she loved you, and say goodbye." And I got to go to her bedroom, hold her hand, pray with her, and kiss her goodbye. And she drew her last breath. So I always see God working in my life, allowing me to make living amends all the time. I just have to remind myself to stay awake in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because once I stop showing up, once I stop praying, once I stop seeking God, once I stop helping another alcoholic, once I stop doing all the things I do on a daily basis for this happy, joyous, and free life I've been given today, I'm on the path back to the next drink. And that will be ugly. Because for this alcoholic, it will be the gates of death, and I know that. So I hope I brought you a good AA meeting. Thank you for the invitation. God bless.